Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everybody. And now we begin our 2013 election series, 30 issues in 30 days. Let others obsess about the horse race, or lack thereof, in New York and New Jersey right now. We will cover the issues and will devote this whole first week to education. Issues 1 through 5 on New York and New Jersey education themes that are relevant to the campaigns. And we'll play a clip of Bill de Blasio and Joe Loda in a minute to hear a very important contrast, I think, on day one. Our first guest is Diane Ravitch, a fierce critic of the Obama, Christie, Bloomberg-style reforms that have been the vogue in recent years, a prominent education official in the H.W. Bush and Clinton administrations. She teaches now at NYU and is author of a new book called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Dr. Ravitch, welcome back to WNYC. Do we have Diane Ravitch there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you perfectly well.
Great, and now I can hear you too. And in the context of an election series, would I be wrong to suggest that essentially Obama, Christie, and Bloomberg have all been barking up the same tree on their approach to improving schools?
Brian, I call it the Bush-Obama era. So, yes, Bush and Obama and Scott Walker, Rick Scott in Florida, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. I could go on with governor after governor pursuing the same strategy of testing, punishment, choice, charter schools, vouchers. Obama administration is not pro-vouchers, but they haven't made a lot of noise against vouchers, which are now spreading across the country.
And I think as we pick apart Bill de Blasio and Joe Loda's specific differences in a little while, they both embrace the Common Core standards coming from the Obama administration as the central organizing principle of public school progress. And somehow beyond them, as you say, Scott Walker and Bobby Jindal, but also Obama and the Koch brothers and the Gates Foundation are all on the same side here. And I think you're one of the few critics of Common Core that I've seen. So how would you describe what it is and what you see as good or bad about those national standards for teaching in many subjects?
My problem with the Common Core is not that there are national standards, but that they've never been tested anywhere. And for 4 years, I've been in conversation with the people who wrote them and also with the White House. I had a meeting at the White House, and I specifically said, field test them before they go out to become national standards. And they said that they didn't want to wait. Secretary Duncan likes to say that this is not their standards, but on the other hand, he defends them at every turn, and he made $5 billion in federal funding contingent on states adopting the Common Core standards. And the problem with them is not that they're good or bad, but that no one knows how they will affect real children in real classrooms. And we now know, based on the New York State Common Core test, that they have widened the achievement gap, that only 5% of students with disabilities pass them, that only about 15% of kids who are either African-American or Hispanic pass them, and that these tests are, frankly, ridiculous because they have been made so rigorous. And in this case, rigorous means that fifth graders are given a test designed for eighth graders, and that's absurd.
And yet, here is New York State Board of Regents Chancellor Merrill Tisch on our show recently. She was also co-chair of the Bill Thompson for Mayor campaign, coincidentally, but she argued that the Common Core standards could lead to standardized tests in New York that are not about teaching to the test. Listen.
I would say that this new push to Common Core will change the paradigm of testing. For a decade, testing has been driving instruction and curriculum. This obsession with drill and kill has been driving what kids are exposed to in the classroom and how classroom time is used. If we start to focus on critical thinking and the development of critical thinking, I believe instruction and curriculum and best practice will drive the test. That is a paradigm shift, and that is why we're taking this on.
New York State Board of Regents Chancellor Merrill Tisch on this program a few weeks ago. So you heard the paradigm shift that she's at least hoping for with Common Core. Common Core promotes critical thinking rather than memorization. Therefore, the tests will have to test critical thinking. Therefore, curriculum will drive the tests rather than the other way around. Does she give you hope?
No, because first of all, the Common Core standards are no curriculum at all. They're simply skill-based standards, and the curriculum is the one designed by New York State. And the Common Core test will all be online, and it's very difficult to test critical thinking online. And any essay questions will be graded by temps who are paid $11 an hour, not by educators. So part of the argument of my book, and this is what I hope we'll be talking about, is that the schools are overloaded right now. Teachers are being massively demoralized, first of all, by race to the top. Tests are being misused. The Common Core comes along at a time when teachers are overloaded with being told that they'll be judged by the test scores. That's what these tests are all about. And I'll tell you why the Common Core tests are actually part of what I call the great hoax, and that is that the purpose of testing is diagnostic. The only valid reason to test kids is to find out if they know what they were taught, and that means that you have to get a timely response. The kids were tested in April. The results came in August. They no longer had the same teacher, and the teachers are not allowed to see where their kids did well and did poorly, but they don't even have the same kids anymore. The only purpose right now of Common Core testing is to come up with grades for students, and 70% of them failed, and grades for teachers, which means that the only valid use of testing, which is diagnostic, has been tossed out. This would be like going to your doctor and getting a checkup and being told something is wrong with you, and I'll let you know what it is in 6 months, but I'm not going to give you the details.
Diane Ravitch, author of Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And you actually suggest in your book that urban public education is not in a crisis, other than that it's under attack by this so-called reform movement. But do you really believe that, given the graduation rates in the city and around the country,
actually,
and how frustrated CUNY is with so many public school grads who aren't ready for community college reading and math when they get there and things like that?
Brian, that's actually not what I say in my book. What I say in my book is that American public education has been, for the past 40 years, actually for the past 100 years, a great success story, and that when you look at the test scores on NAEP, which is a no-stakes exam, they have been going up and up and up ever since 1971, when we started testing nationally. There have been dramatic gains for white students, black students, Hispanic students, and Asian students. Graduation rates have gone up for the past 100 years. Dropout rate today is the lowest it's ever been in history. The place where there is a crisis is in the urban districts, and the reason there is a crisis is because of the combination of segregation, racial segregation, and high poverty, and high levels of kids with disabilities, which is different from the rest of the country. So there's, on one hand, a great success story, which is American public education, but on the other hand, there is a crisis in urban districts caused by poverty. And by the way, as you well know, the poverty rates are up for New York City as they are up across the country.
So No Child Left Behind, which you once supported, was largely based on measuring the success of schools by the success of low-income populations coming closer to that same standardized test score average as wealthier populations, reflecting a learning of the basics, if they were really reflecting anything. Is there a difference, then, in your opinion, between the approach needed in low-income schools, communities with a lot of poverty and not well-educated parents and so forth, and the education that's needed in the schools with better educated and more affluent populations?
Yes. Low-income schools need smaller classes. They need more arts programs. They need health services. They need guidance counselors and social workers. They need physical education every day. There are many things that they need. They need all the same things that children in the affluent communities have, but they need more of it.
Diane Ravitch, my guest, and this is WNYC, FM, AM, and HD, New York, and the stations of New Jersey Public Radio, WNJT, FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. And listeners, we can take your phone calls for Diane Ravitch here at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Before we go to some calls, let's go back to the New York City mayoral race and put what you've been writing about and talking about in the context of this election. Bill de Blasio and Joe Lota do have some differences here, and they've really been coming to the fore for people paying attention over the last few days. De Blasio seems to be getting ready to break with Bloomberg and, by extension, Obama on some details, including a moratorium on charter schools and a moratorium on closing failing schools. Here's de Blasio talking about it at a UFT-sponsored forum back in May.
I was outside Wadley and Brandeis and PS114 in Brooklyn, Canarsie, fighting against closures and co-locations that were wrong. And I stood up time and time again when this administration tried to attack teachers, tried to disempower parents, etc. Look at the record of each and every person up here before you decide. That's all I can say. Were they real? Did they stand up, or did they just talk about it?
So Bill de Blasio wanting a moratorium on co-locations of charter schools, as well as more charter schools, co-locations meaning in the same building as regular public schools, also a moratorium on closing failing schools. Lota was quoted in the Wall Street Journal the other day saying two of de Blasio's proposals alone would annihilate the charter school movement in the city, and he used the word annihilate, charging charters rent if they're located in city buildings, and not co-locating them in the same buildings as public schools. And here is Joe Lota defending the charter school movement in a talk back in June before the Association for a Better New York.
I've seen them. I've been there. The great ones are better than our regular schools. The ones that haven't worked have been closed. But they all have the potential of improving education of every single student in the city. Parents want and deserve choices for their children. I will provide parents with choice and with more choice. I will call for legislation expanding the number of charter public schools in the city of New York. At a minimum, the number must need to double.
So, listeners, you can hear the very clear issue difference on that between de Blasio and Lota. And Diane Ravitch, do you agree, before we get into your critique of the charter school movement in general, do you agree with Lota's political analysis that just those two things that de Blasio is proposing, charging rent to charters if they're in city buildings and not co-locating them in the same buildings as public schools, would destroy the charter school movement in the city?
Absolutely not. I think Lota is wrong. To be perfectly frank, I endorse Bill de Blasio because I think he will represent a sharp break from the Bloomberg education program. I think the Bloomberg education program is overwhelmingly rejected by New Yorkers. All of the polls I've seen, whether it was Quinnipiac or Marist or the New York Times, said that only 20 to 25% of New Yorkers like the Bloomberg education policies. People in this city, in New York City, live in neighborhoods. They live in communities. Bloomberg has done everything possible to destroy community schools and neighborhood schools. And the challenge for the next mayor is, how do we create good public schools in every neighborhood? Not how do we destroy public schools, how do we shove privately managed charter schools into public space, because we end up with academic apartheid, with an overcrowded urban classroom with too many children in it. Instead of getting smaller classes, they lose their facilities to a well-funded charter school, which has billionaires on the school board, and that's not right. And they're all the charter schools, as I think most people understand, skim kids. They have the freedom to accept who they want to accept. They take half as many kids with English language difficulties. They take very few children with disabilities. And so the public schools then get overloaded with the children who are the most challenging and the neediest, those with the greatest needs.
But on that skimming, don't charters in New York have to admit by lottery so the students are coming from the same populations?
The lottery itself is a form of exclusion because the most dysfunctional families, the homeless families, of whom there are tens of thousands, don't apply to lotteries. So that's a skimming device in itself. They are then free to kick out or to exclude or to counsel out the kids that they don't want, and there have been many examples of this. You can also look at the numbers posted on New York City or New York State website or even the Charter School Center website. The charters have literally enroll half as many children who are English language learners, and very few children with severe disabilities. They take the children with the mildest disabilities, with speech disabilities, not the children who have severe disabilities.
Let's take a phone call. And our first caller is Boris in Flatbush. You're on WNYC. Hello, Boris.
Hi, Brian. Hello, Ms. Radich. How are you? Just wanted to say that I emigrated from the Soviet Union when I was in the, second grade, and I did not need to learn any new math until I was in the fifth grade. So the same thing that was being taught in the second grade in Ukraine, Soviet Ukraine, was being taught to fifth graders in New York. And furthermore, people were coming out equally educated after 10 years of school in the Soviet Union, whereas we, bring people out after 12 years at the same level. So I think there's plenty of room for improvement in the public school system. And I would just say that to say that if charters only produce great, successes 10% of the time, well, that's like DARPA, and the 10% that they're successful, they also create Predator drones and the Internet. So I think if they are the place where experimentation could achieve great success, I think we should put our bet there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Dr. Abbott, what would you say to Boris?
I don't think there's any evidence that charters do produce greater successes. We have many studies that compare charters to regular public schools, and they seldom, occasionally there's a better charter school, just as often there's a better public school. Our most brilliant scientists and Nobelists went to New York City public schools and other public schools around the country. They're not coming out of charter schools. So the charter schools have a lot to learn from the public schools, and many of the charter schools that are posting high test scores are doing a lot of rote learning and drill and kill, and that's not what produces our Nobel Prize-winning scientists. What we have succeeded at dramatically, far more than the Soviet Union, by the way, is in terms of creativity, originality, risk-taking, and the people who break the mold because they haven't been taught by rote learning. They've been taught by the more American methods of creativity and originality.
But doesn't that go along with what he said is part of the underlying principle behind the charter schools that I think a lot of Republicans and Democrats alike who support the movement would say, that they see charter schools as a way to let 1,000 experiments bloom in a decentralized way and then learn from the best, rather than having the one-size-fits-all teacher-as-widgets approach, which I think is how you see the centralized New York City school system.
Well, actually, I hate what's going on in public education today. I don't want to go back to the old days. I want to go forward to a different paradigm where teachers have professionalism, where most of our testing is designed by teachers because they know the kids, they get instant feedback. This is what's done in most of the rest of the world. We're the only country in the world that has national or state tests where kids are tested every single year, the only country in the world, including the old Soviet Union. In other countries, kids during their entire school career may two or three times take a standardized test. In this country, it's every year. And then we spend hundreds of millions, in fact, billions of dollars nationally on tests. This benefits only the testing industry. As far as 1,000 flowers blooming, we are not seeing a great deal of originality coming out of the charter movement. What we're seeing instead is the no-excuses boot camp approach, which, if you've ever been in these schools, is very reminiscent of a 19th-century school. So if originality and innovation means going back to the 19th century, I say that's not the direction I'd like to go. I'd like to see us go in the direction of the 21st century.
And what about the charter school success stories? And even Loda in that clip said, I've seen them, I've been there, the great ones are better than our regular schools. He acknowledges that many are not. And what I've read about the studies on charter schools say they do not do better than regular public schools in general, but do so in low-income urban settings. Also, on the recent controversial New York State standardized tests that we were discussing that were made harder after the previous scandal of the test being too easy, certain charter schools like Eva Moskowitz's Success Academies, as controversial as they are, did outperform the publics and outperformed other charter schools. So is there something to be learned from some of what they're doing?
Well, I think that Eva Moskowitz needs to take over an entire school district so that she can show what she can do. And she takes all the kids with disabilities, the kids who don't read or speak English. That would be a proof of her methods. I think the important point to learn from the Common Core test, however, is that the public schools actually did much better than the charter schools. The charter schools fell harder and faster than the public schools. The scores dropped across the board, but they dropped farther and faster in the charter schools. Eva Moskowitz's schools were an exception to that. I do think that we should get over this idea that somehow charter schools have some secret sauce, because charter schools have a lot to learn from public schools. We have some incredibly successful public schools in New York City and across the country, and they're being ruined by the, first of all, by all this excessive testing, which, as I said, does nothing other than to waste class time, cause schools to drop the arts, drop physical education, reduce the time for history and for foreign languages. We're in a ridiculous time right now where public schools are being beat up on from all sides. And they are one of the essential institutions of a democratic society. I don't want our country to be like Singapore. I don't want our country to be like the old Soviet Union. I want our country to be the most creative and the most technologically innovative country in the world, as it has been for a long time.
Former Assistant Education Secretary Diane Ravitch, author of Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And Alice, can I take that call? Alice in Englewood, you're on WNYC, I think. Alice, you there? All right. I think we have to get that line ready. So let's try someone else. Sarah in Brooklyn, a mother of two in elementary school. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, hi, Brian. How are you doing?
Good.
Good. Thanks for having Ms. Ravitch on the phone today, on the air today. I just wanted to speak to this idea that the charter schools are going to go bankrupt, per Joe Loda, if they are charged rent. I mean, currently, right now, the existing public schools that they're co-located into actually are paying for all the facility out of their own budget, and the charter school is basically coming in and not paying anything. So they should be paying their share. The other thing is, I don't know if you've been aware of the celebrated cases of Success Academy coming into Carroll Gardens or also into Williamsburg, but those schools were not necessarily in great condition. But once the charter school came in there, certain floors were renovated for the charter school and not for the regular students. And this is patently unfair. This is wrong.
So this treatment is infuriating to you as a mother of two.
As a public school parent, yeah, it shouldn't be happening. The other thing is that sometimes, yes, they are co-located in schools that may not have that high a population in the school. But what that means is that children who need special services are getting a room to have those services in. And frequently, when the charter school moves in, it increases all the class sizes because they've taken a floor or two. And then there's no place for special services. And so they're having them in a hallway.
Sarah, thank you very much. And here's a parent with a different view, whose son, I think, goes to a charter school, Bree in Clinton Hill. Bree, thanks for calling in.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I love your show.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'm a mother of a third grader at Community Roots Charter School. This is opposite from a No Excuses boot camp. It's progressive. Our classes are all inclusive. There are 25 kids and two lead teachers, one specializing in general ed and one at least one with a special education background, but you really can't tell who's who. And there are a lot of learning specialists, and it's great. I wish every child could get this kind of an education. There's critical thinking. The directors are Bank Street educators. That's where they met. And I just wouldn't want a school like my school to not be able to exist. I think it's should be a model school. There are 1,000 people on the wait list, which is all lottery. In terms of skimming from the top, the school has a rule introduced by the directors of the school that we would take a minimum of 40% from the surrounding housing project that helps with the socioeconomic diversity. But also, when Diane is talking about strong community schools, the problem, and you can see this in parks at a school like 321, where I heard Diane speak, the problem is you can buy a $2 million brownstone and get your kid into a public zone school like 321, and a school that pulls from the entire district where there's a larger catchment zone, you get better socioeconomic diversity. So the whole lottery system can work to promote diversity, as our school does.
Bree, thank you for your call. Diane Ravitch, what would you say to her?
Well, I'm familiar with the founders of Community Roots. I've heard only wonderful things about it. I think I have a chapter at the end of my book in which I say we need good community-based charter schools that are of the community and in the community. What we are getting more and more of, and my book is a national book. It's not about New York City per se. It's a national look at the charter movement, and there are more and more states that have for-profit charters that are rapacious. The state of Michigan, more than 80% of the charters operate for-profit. Florida is overrun with for-profit charters. The for-profit people come in and give a no-excuses, bare-bones education, and they make a lot of money, usually on real estate deals. And by the way, some of those for-profit operators are in New York City and making millions and millions of dollars, taking about a third of all their public allotment and returning it as to their investors. So Community Roots is the kind of charter school that I certainly approve of, but unfortunately it is not typical of the charter movement as a whole, which has become a movement that is funded by some of the wealthiest people in America, some of the most right-wing people in America. If you look to the most reactionary governors, whether it's Bobby Jindal in Louisiana, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Rick Scott in Florida, Tom Corbett in Pennsylvania, and I could go on, John Kasich in Ohio, they're taking a lot of money from charter operators. Their biggest campaign contributors are charter operators, and they want the charter movement to expand and to be a moneymaker for their campaign contributors. So I'm happy to see Community Roots flourish, and I wish them well. I wish they were typical, but unfortunately, this movement has been taken over by the Walton Family Foundation and by some of the most reactionary elements of our society.
And Bree and Sarah, who was on just before you, maybe you'll both be interested to know that our issue number two tomorrow in 30 issues in 30 days during this mayoral election and New Jersey gubernatorial and Senate election series will be specifically on parental involvement in public schools, which also has become an issue, at least in the New York City mayoral campaign. But Diane Ravitch, as we wrap up with you, given that political landscape that you just laid out and what some of the most right-wing elements want from supporting the privatization movement so strongly, how do you explain the breadth of the coalition to include President Obama and many other Democrats and people who would consider themselves liberals embracing the same movement in the name of choice?
Well, the privatization movement is very powerful because there's so many wealthy people behind it. An awful lot of people from the hedge fund industry and a lot of people on Wall Street have decided that charter schools is their hobby. And so they give a lot of money to politics. In Pennsylvania, the single biggest contributor to the governor's campaign is a charter operator who runs an operation where he has made tens of millions of dollars. The biggest campaign contributors in Ohio, again, charter operators. So there's a lot of political money supporting this movement. What I would say is the other side is if you could take all of this, the people supporting privatization, whether it's President Obama or Scott Walker or any of these right-wing people, plus their campaign contributors, they would all fit into, I suspect, a rather small stadium. On the other side, though, are the 90% of American students who go to public schools and their parents and their teachers, millions of people who are sick of the testing, sick of the over-testing, sick of the misuse of testing, sick of the privatization, and want to have better public schools. They don't like what we're getting. I'm not defending anything about the status quo. What I'm describing, the privatization movement and the testing movement have merged to become the status quo, whether it's Bloomberg or Bobby Jindal. And Bloomberg invested a lot of money, by the way, in the Jindal race to make sure that Jindal took control of the State Board of Education in Louisiana. I believe what's going to happen and what has started to happen is a huge pushback where parents and teachers and even kids are getting involved. In Providence, Rhode Island, there's a Providence Student Union. In Seattle, Washington, the teachers boycotted one of the mandated state tests. In the state of Texas, the parental anger about the overtesting, where Pearson got a $500 million contract at the same time that the schools were being cut by $5 billion. Parents got so angry that they forced the legislature, a bipartisan vote, to roll back a lot of the state testing. Hmm. We're beginning to see this movement congeal, and I believe by next spring there is going to be a massive opt-out. It'll be across New York State. It'll be across the country. We're going to see many, many parents saying, I am not going to allow my child to take the test because this is abusive, unnecessary. And this whole house of cards that's been built on the standardized tests, which, by the way, aren't even that good, and the Atlanta Journal-Constitution over the past couple of weeks has been running a series about how many errors there were in the standardized tests that we're using to judge the quality of students, teachers, and schools, and then to close schools based on these flawed instruments, which are not scientific. There's going to be a massive pushback, and it's already started, and I believe that eventually this house of cards is coming down.
And Diane Ravitch's new book is called Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, environmentalist Bill McKibben, and then we'll take calls from some of our Catholic listeners. If you went to Mass yesterday, what did you hear in church after the Pope made all those waves last week saying the church has been too obsessed with homosexuality and contraception and abortion? Did your priest seem like he was down with that? So we'll take those calls in a little while. You can start tweeting what you heard in church yesterday at Brian Lehrer, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But coming up next, environmentalist Bill McKibben. Stay tuned.